Okay, good. We are recording. It's the 9th.
Today is the 8th,
Today is
actually.
the 8th of October, and I'm in Valdez once again with John Devins, Sr. And I just wanted to add just a few things back onto the record about the story that I missed the first time around. No one has told me. I know that there was dense air traffic at the time, but I have never quite heard the precise figures, and I read them, and they were startling. So tell me, please, about that.
Well, it was very frightening the first couple of days. I mean, the first day, of course, we were just inundated with so many just problems that we had never thought about before. But it was brought to my attention early on that we had like maybe as much as 700 takeoffs and landings and people coming, the press and all kinds of observers coming and flying light aircraft over the site. So I got a hold of the FAA, and Valdez Airport has a flight tower, but it had been deactivated years before. And I called the FAA and said, "We've got to get it activated. We're going to have some flight control here, or we're going to kill somebody." And they did. And fortunately, we didn't have any accidents. But it was a miracle we didn't, because it was just so much traffic.
It boggles the mind to think of that little airport being able to handle all
Well,
that.
and aircraft, everything from Hercs to single engine Pipers, they were all coming in and going out, and they were trying to bring equipment in by air as well as bringing it in by water and by road. And it was just a circus here for several days. And then you had great amounts of trouble communicating, because we only had so many lines coming into Valdez. So the phones were totally jammed up, and the airwaves were getting jammed up because you had so much radio traffic going on. So yeah, those first few days, it's a wonder we didn't have more personal disasters than we did have.
Right. And you said a thing to me that had not been said yet, and that was about Exxon's refusal to pay for mental health care.
That was something that was very confusing to us to begin with. We were trying Exxon. Well, Frank Iarossi immediately stood up in front of God and everybody and said, "We will take care of all the expenses. We're going to stand behind this. Nobody's going to lose anything." And I think Frank really meant it. I think Frank was basically a pretty good guy. But when his bean counters came in, it was a different story. And I could ask for additional garbage men and, refuse collection. They understood that, and they would do that. But if we asked for any kind of mental health experts, more counseling, if we indicated that there was a drug problem, because there was a drug problem, and there was an alcohol problem, and there was a lot of family abuse problems, and there were a lot of crime rate went up during that period of time.
The divorce rate.
The divorce rate. We had lots of people that broke up, that went out, and they'd spend weeks out in the Sound, and suddenly relationships would fall apart, and they would just cease to exist because it was the stress as well as just the temptation of being out there on a boat with somebody strange.
Right.
We had an awful lot of that going on.
And then that would trickle down to the children.
The children, I hate to think of the problems that probably occurred with the children, because you had families where maybe both the husband and wife worked, and maybe they were in lower paid jobs. Suddenly they had an opportunity to go out on the Sound, stay out there for weeks at a time at $17 an hour plus time and a half for overtime, and you couldn't spend money out there because all of
Right.
your accommodations were taken care of. So I often wondered, well, what happened to those kids? Were they dumped on grandparents or neighbors, or what happened to the children that belonged to the working couples? Or in some cases, maybe the wife stayed in Valdez and the husband went out, but then all of a sudden she was faced with doing everything and taking care of the kids
on
her own.
That itself is problematic.
Yeah. And it wasn't always that way. Sometimes it was the wife that went out and worked out there, and the husband stayed here because maybe he had a little bit better job, but then you still had those children that, at least during the day when the husband was working, they were kind of on their own. I've made mention of it before. I mean, the number of automobiles that were stolen in Valdez in September was remarkable, considering that the first crossroads where you can actually go anyplace is 115 miles up the road. Automobile theft has not been a real big problem in this area, but it was that fall. And then, of course, you had the problems of so many of our boat owners, not necessarily fishermen, but anybody that had anything that floated, if they played it right, they could get it on the spill and get money. And a lot of those people lost their sense. They were buying bigger and more expensive boats. It was like, oh, I've got a whole new livelihood. This is a new profession for me. I'm going to be Prince William Sound cleanup crew. And I would go on the radio, and I'd be on television saying, people, this is over. Come September, they're going home, and you're not going to have this anymore. Don't invest all of your money into these big boats, because next year, and everybody thought they'd come back the next year, but those of us who were kind of on the inside, we knew. And in fact, there was a memo that was leaked to us that was from some of the Exxon officials who were saying to their foreman that, no, this is it. We will close down in September and October, and that's it. We're all going home.
Now, one other issue that I would like you to speak to, I'm trying to run down a woman who currently works at the hospital and was working at the hospital back then, and she was telling Donna the story that the hospital's census went from 2 beds to 100 beds in a space of just a very short period of time, and yet the common perception is that there was no illness from the oil spill. So I figured, as mayor, you would have some insight into what was happening with the hospital and that part of the whole civic readjustment.
Well, Exxon likes to say, and Vico liked to say, that there were no deaths associated with the spill. That's not entirely true. There were some deaths that did occur, but there were a lot of injuries, and there was a lot of sickness from exposure to the chemicals, both the fumes from the oil as well as some of the dispersants and Inapol. There was a lot of sickness from that. There was a lot of injuries. We weren't very smart, or we weren't very knowledgeable. I guess we were just as smart as we are today, but we weren't very knowledgeable back then. And I remember I talked to some of the workers when they came back after the first go-around out there, which was weeks long. They were out, and they were pulling nets or booming material. In fact, I had a picture a reporter gave me of my son John, who was a foreman out there, and he was covered in oil. He was waist deep in the oil, and he was pulling a boom. And I've often wondered, will someday see some problems come along from his exposure to the oil. But we had a lot of people that the foreman out there would say to them, well, it's just oil, it's nothing going to hurt you. Well, today we know, yeah, it can hurt you. The first people at the site where they were taking the oil off of the Exxon Valdez, there was this huge, huge lake of oil out there with fumes. And the early people, they had respiratory problems, their eyes were bothering, they were getting rashes. today, you know, you wouldn't let anybody in that area unless they had respirators on and they had protective equipment. But back in 89, nobody realized the harm that could come from exposure to all of the chemicals they were exposed to. And then, of course, we had the additional problem of literally thousands of people that had come to Valdez. I mean, we went from about 4,000 people to someplace between 12,000 and 15,000 people.
Oh, and right. That was the thing that I wanted you to say. I was interviewing Shayna Anderson earlier, and I wanted to speak with her primarily about her work with the incineration of the animals. However, she did mention that in her other duties, she was around town taking, you know, care, addressing parking issues and also the camping thing. And she said, it's kind of a startling thing, that there were, in her words, she said that every square inch of Valdez was populated by someone, and that it stretched for miles. I mean, I don't know if she said 6 or 8 miles out the road where people were camping.
Yes, it was. The people were camping every place you could find any square footage, and if you happened to be one who was lucky enough to have had a motor home or a camper, and you got that thing parked someplace, you didn't move it. So that meant that you dumped your tanks right there.
Right.
And we had open sewerage around town that it's a wonder we didn't have major outbreaks of diseases. I mean, we had some cases. The hospital picked up on some very communicable diseases, but either we were just lucky as the dickens or we handled it well, but we didn't have any major outbreaks. But there were people that were sick. Nobody ever locked their cars until that summer. And then you'd have to lock your car. You'd get up in the morning and go out to go to work, and you might have 2 or 3 people sleeping in your car. If they could get a hold of pieces of Visqueen, they would make tents. And you might have people sleeping in your yard or under your porch if you happen to have a porch. I mean, any place they could go. The impact that Valdez had was more of a people impact. We never really saw much oil here. A little bit came back in on some of the boats when they came in. But mainly our impact was people and trying to work with them. And then the agencies, everybody was coming here to help us. But, you know, the old story, I'm from the government, I'm here to help. And then they broke laws and ignored our zoning ordinances, and it was a nightmare just keeping things in order, finding office space for people, because there just weren't places for everybody. And I think I've told you before, I mean, how they literally took over the college, and willingly I gave it to them until finally we had some people from university's administration come down, our property management people, and they were here for a few days trying to get something done with Exxon, because they were using the college. Well, we lost all our students. The students all went out to work on the spill. So what we had was an empty college, so we turned the college over to them for animal rehab. And then they could use our computers, because we had a lot of good computers in the college, and they might as well be using them. But the deal that I had made, verbal deal, was that, you're going to have to pay for this. I mean, you're going to have to put everything back right when it's done. And not that we were trying to make money from them, but we didn't want to lose money on it either. After people from our lands management group came down, and they got totally disgusted and borrowed a car and drove back to Anchorage, that's when I wrote a letter to Exxon, and I said, I'm holding you in criminal trespass if you don't sign a contract here in the next 2 days. And they did.
And that was at what point?
That would have been several weeks into it, maybe even a month. Because at first everything was so disorderly, it was just not possible to get things squared away. The paperwork just wasn't flowing until we started to get our feet on the ground.
It seems to me, having talked to quite a few more people since the last time we spoke,
this is John. Yeah, Gregory, let me call you back. I'm being interviewed. Okay, thanks.
That there must have been times especially in the earlier days when this really felt... I'm going to go close that door.
Yeah.
That it felt...
It's distracting me.
That it felt impossible to handle. That it was just too big to take control of.
Well, it was. I think we made a lot of good decisions. Some of it was because we called other places that had similar emergencies and got some good advice. We had a lot of people that were helping us in those days, but it was overwhelming. I mean, I couldn't do it today. I require more sleep than I required then. But just all of the assortment of things. You have thousands of people descending on your city. You have all these aircraft that are flying around. You have the problems of public health. You have the mental health problems. You have the contracts, and at the time, everybody said, you know, well, you're going to want to sue them, so you've got to keep all of these records. And then throughout all of that, you've got congressional hearings, and I was flying back to Washington, D.C. to testify. So it took us a good 4 or 5 weeks before we really got our feet on the ground and got things stabilized a bit. And of course, it helped a little bit when they started moving people out of town and out to the islands where they were working. So it took a little of the pressure off, but it also took all of our support services out. We didn't have anybody to work the restaurants or the hotels. And like I say, I didn't have any students.
So just a final word here, and back to the issue of mental health and Exxon's refusal to pay for that. And you, I don't think we got this on tape, about your thought about that was that Exxon did not want to set itself up for the liability of, I guess I need you to articulate that.
I think probably Exxon's legal counsel, and I have to say probably because we never got an explanation, but I know they were very generous about a lot of things. If we said we needed more police officers, more refuse collectors, those we were never denied. But anytime we asked for anything about that had to do with mental health, we couldn't get that. And as I talked to other mayors, they had similar kinds of problems. And our conclusion was that probably the attorneys have said, you know, you don't want to admit that this event was causing mental illness. You don't want to admit that people started to drink alcohol more or started using drugs or became abusive in their homes. And that was the only thing we could think of, because it was very, very obvious to us that they were not going to fund any kind of mental health.
My own thought about that is that that's a Pandora's box.
Yeah. Well, I think it is a Pandora's box, and I suppose that's why their attorneys are saying, you know, it's one thing if somebody comes in with a broken leg. That's pretty objective. You can measure that and you can fix it. But if somebody says, oh, you know, I was a teetotaling sober guy and your damned oil spill drove me to alcoholism and now I'm an alcoholic for the rest of my life.
Now I'm just...
How do you pay for that?
Right. And then that sets a precedent for all these other people in the same boat.
Well, and you know, there were a lot of things like that. Well, you remember all of the controversy following the spill in terms of what's an otter worth? What's a bird worth? What is the loss of the use or the loss of the appreciation for the animals or the beaches that were ruined? And so there's an awful lot of legal implication, which here 18 years later, we're still fighting over.
Right.
And of course, there's a lot of lawsuits or pending lawsuits with regard to health problems that were caused. And I don't know anybody that is talking about mental health problems, but we know that there are a lot of people that have physical problems, but it's so hard to prove it because there are so many other things that could cause it.
Yes.
You know, it's just very hard. Right. You know, you say, well, geez, I've got this terrible lung condition and it started when I was breathing your damn fumes. And, but yeah, I'm a smoker. And
yeah.
I worked on a boat and yeah, there were fumes there too. And, you know, it's just getting it down. I know Ricky Ott has tried to promote this. And she, at one point it looked like there was a law firm that was ready to take it on as a class action. But,
yeah.
But it's real hard to prove it.
Yeah, especially when you're wealthy enough to hire the finest.
Well, that's right.
Attorneys in the world.
Well, it was always interesting. As mayor here, before the spill, I had to deal with the three majors. At that time, it was Exxon, ARCO, and British Petroleum. And it was interesting that when we would get into arguments over tax, because Valdez always said, you're undervaluing the oil property, because Valdez taxed it in a huge percentage of our tax base. I mean, by far the lion's share of our tax base came from the oil property. Well, the oil industry would negotiate with the state. Now, you or I, if we have property that's going to be taxed by the municipality or the state, we don't really get to go in and negotiate it. But if you're a big oil company, you get to negotiate it. Well, they would negotiate it. And then we would always go in, and it was Bill Walker, who was our city attorney, and I would go, and we would argue our side of the case. But it was always Exxon's attorneys. Exxon's attorneys, top drawer, very well paid, and very, very difficult to deal with. But it was always Exxon. ARCO, they were the nice guys. BP, they tried to be the nice guys. And Exxon, I don't think ever gave a damn. And they still don't.
Yeah, right.
They just don't. You know, public relations is not a big issue for the Exxon Corporation. It never has been.
Yeah.
And they handled it in 89. I couldn't imagine a company handling public relations worse than Exxon did. Everything they did seemed to be wrong. In fact, I understand there are classes today being taught in universities of how not to handle public relations in the event of a disaster.
And with they, Exxon as their
they
model.
Use Exxon as the example. Yeah.
Okay, well, is there anything else that you remember from the interview that you wish you had said?
Yeah, I'm having trouble remembering what I did say in the interview.
Well, suffice it to say that once we get it transcribed and send it to you, that you can add on or we'll figure out a way to.
It seems to me that the interesting thing in terms of my role was just the confusion and going from one day having a community of 4,000 or less people to within a day being up to 12,000 to 15,000 people and trying to keep order and keep everybody functioning. And then, you know, and I've always complained, and I think that's where the oil mayors came from and where RCAC came from, was the citizens couldn't get into the decision-making or information loop. It's like somebody coming in your home and spilling some nasty substance on your carpet and telling you to get out of your house. They'll take care of it and tell you when you can come back. And that was pretty much the way we felt. We didn't feel that we were listened to, and that's what forced us into forming the Oil Mayors Group. And then different people have different stories in terms of how RCAC was formed, but essentially it came out of that kind of, we want the people that live in an area want to have some sense of control over their lives. And if you're the one that is going to lose the most from something like an oil spill, then you certainly want to have the ability to make decisions and to oversee what's going on. And we didn't feel that we had that.
Yes. Okay. Well, great.
Well, I'm excited to see